In the Garden, Episode 10. This is the Yahweh Blog, and I am your host, Craig Wynn. According to Yahweh, in the opening book of the Torah, Bereshith, the woman said to the tempting and toxic creature, "From the fruit of the tree of the garden we can eat, but the fruit of the tree which is in the center of the garden, God said you should not actually make a habit of eating from it. In addition, you guys should not make contact with it, lest you will have chosen to die." Genesis 3:3. Now, the fact is here that Yahweh spoke of only one acceptable tree when God said that all of the trees would be nourishing. And by not naming the tree of the knowledge of good and bad, it appears that she never actually grasped the consequence or the merit of that particular tree. Also, Yahweh said nothing of touching, making this an embellishment. Adding to our opinions or edicts to Yahweh's instructions is contrary to God's Torah teaching. It is considered a form of corruption. Moreover, since the paragogic nun suspects to muth die as a variation of the cohortative, this expression of first-person volition, which Yahweh conveyed, well, it may have been true. God did not actually say. It is interesting, however, that pen, which means lest, from pana, which means to turn away, and this is the point and consequence of all of this. Yahweh's augmentation, while extrapolated from a nugget of truth, took away from the intent that, and the insight that we are influenced by what we consume, not by what we touch. There are lots of people who are asked to go in and rid the world of that which is infectious or counterproductive, but they don't ingest the toxins while they are there and are actually performing a valuable service. There are a number of telling insights which can be deduced from Yahweh's mischaracterizations. The first, and I think the most important of these, is something I shared at the conclusion of our last program. And that is that it is likely that Adam did an inadequate job of conveying Yahweh's instructions to her. If you recall, it was to Adam that these instructions were given before Yahweh came to exist. Now, if that is the case, and it appears so by what we read in the text, we ought to all learn a lesson and be more diligent around those we love. Now, it's also possible that Yahweh would just simply miffed at Adam, or could have been miffed at Yahweh. She wanted to elevate herself to divine status. So while she was Adam's equal, highly valued and appreciated, she was living in paradise, she was also an afterthought, a gift that Yahweh had provided to Adam. She may have resented one or the other for these reasons. It is possible that Yahweh never bonded with Yahweh either. Well, that, at least to the extent, I should say, of the close relationship that Yahweh had with Adam. While we are not told, perhaps even now, Adam may have been could have been off exploring with Yahweh, could have left Yahweh home alone, just as a isolation, and this is something we discussed early on in this process, was not good for man. It would not have been good for woman either. When we engage in a relationship, we have a responsibility to be attentive to one another to the extent it is prudent and possible. Now, having neglected Yahweh, if that is to be concluded from this evidence, Adam may have enjoyed being enlightened by God more than his companion. Now, if the choice is You know, my wife for Yahweh, I love my wife. She is wonderful to be around. She's exceedingly bright. She is enormously supportive. But even then, Yahweh is exceptional. And if the roles were reversed, she'd make exactly the same decision. So this is just part of who we are and who God is. Now, if that's true, one day when Adam and Yah were out tending to the garden, Yahweh may have been bored. This would then speak of the value of work and of constantly learning over being idle. While it is a overgeneralization with countless exceptions and may have evolved over time, throughout the ages, men have responded more to reason and women more to feelings. Consider Chawa's Naga. And clearly, having read Dode's Psalms and then the book of Ezekiel, it is obvious that Yahweh prefers thoughts to emotions. Chawa may have had an independent streak, a desire to carve out a niche on her own. After all, Adam had a relationship with Yahweh for mental stimulation and for daily physical exertion while caring for the garden. Chawa's role was to help him. In doing so, she would have engendered a loving and supportive response, which is the essence of an enjoyable and enduring relationship. But there is no indication that she actually engaged to support him or to work with either of them. Not a word is said. And if she had done something exemplary, we would have heard about it. Also, if Chawa thought that she was obliged to do things she had not chosen, or if her contributions were not reciprocated or valued, she may have been looking for a way out of this arrangement. When we interact under obligation rather than desire, we foreclose the joys of reciprocation, which make love so enchanting. Let me give you an example. Men and women coming together to conceive and raise children is divine. But Christianity and Judaism, wedding vows were inspired by men, not God. Such is the case with divorce, where all the Torah requests is a letter delineating the desire for separation. Since everlasting misery and ongoing conflict are not God's idea of a good time, nor appropriate for a eternal family, he did not convey, until death do you part. I did get a letter. And one of these programs about marriage, and he says, you know, you hate marriage so much, you know, have you ever considered all the things that would happen? People would be out fornicating, and you know, they would just go out and be hip-hopping around to whoever they see next. And God, wouldn't that be just awful if all you had to do for a divorce is to write a letter? God, let's say, wait a minute. First of all, I'm telling you what God conveyed to us. If you don't like it, take it up with him. See how that works out for you. No, I've just learned a long time ago that if I tell you what God tells us, then I'm on pretty sound footing. It's obvious that God was not a fan of or a proponent of monogamy and human affairs. You know, almost everyone that he worked through had multiple wives and sexual liaisons. His favorite was Dode. What, 8 wives, 10 other lovers? So that's not an issue with God. There simply is no wedding ceremony in the Torah. You move into one another's tent and you conceive children, then, you know, you're married by the sense of that we would convey the word. Although there is no word for marriage, there's no word even for husband or wife. It's just simply men and women. You know, we come together, and when things are right, we build a loving home. We shelter our children. We raise them. We care for them. We pour our lives into them. We nourish them, and we love each other and support each other as husband and wife, mother and father. a man and woman in the process. This is what we do. And when we do these things, it works out well. We model the covenant. When we do them poorly, well, Yahweh knows all too well why, when your those that you have loved do not love you in return, that it's time to write a letter. He did in Hosea and say, we're going to have a timeout. This is a time for separation. Consider this a divorce, if you will. And it's we realize that children and parents and up and down the line often don't get along. In fact, most human relationships are badly fractured at the family level. And Yahweh experienced it too. He had to say in Hosea, you're not my children. So God knows it. And he knows that the human experience is badly damaged, and therefore we all experience these things, which is why his covenant family is a contrast to them. But, you know, this idea of fornication is Christian. God created us to be sexual beings, to enjoy one another's company, to be productive as it relates to raising and nurturing children. He did not design our physical bodies to be attractive to one another just to torment us, I can assure you. And so I think that his way of going about it is actually vastly superior. If you don't, then that's your choice, free will and all. But the problem with the Christian culture, and even in Judaism and the Jewish culture, is that the religious have imposed their values on others. And now there are countless people trying to defend religious values, and God doesn't agree with them and doesn't support them. So this is the message being conveyed. Everlasting misery is not a good idea, and so Yahweh made it possible for us to go off and explore new relationships. I can tell you that it worked beautifully for my wife and I, and I'm sure that we are not the only ones. Now, said another way, being kind, affectionate, uplifting will engender far more desirable responses than being commanding, controlling, or imposing. Holding a piece of paper over someone's head and said, you know, you signed this, therefore you're bound by it forever, no matter how miserable the relationship is, just makes the relationship more miserable. Chawa simply chosen to go out and explore the garden with Adam, her life would have been more exhilarating and rewarding. The more each of us contribute of our own volition to one another, the more enjoyable and stimulating the relationship becomes. Had that been the case, it is unlikely that Chawa would have been alone, much less listened to that duplicitous devil. Handsome and charming as he may be. One of the things too that, you know, you spend time in social media as I'm doing these days, you'll see a whole lot of people positioning the devil as this red colored fellow with horns, and he's got a pitchfork and tail, and he looks really menacing and devilish as the case may be. That's not what Satan looks like. Satan was a cherub, which means he looks like those, certainly would have looked like at this point, the two cherubim that formed the sides and the back of the Ark of the Covenant. Beautiful winged creatures. God created them to be beautiful. He would have come down and looked that way. So the Nakash, serpentine metaphor being used in this case, describes his approach, describes his lack of being straightforward. It describes his toxic nature. This is something that we typically miss in all of this. There's this tendency to depict Yahweh's Malach as angels because of the transliteration of the Greek word for messenger. And then we have them as pretty girls with really flowing robes and beautiful hair and wings. But that's just not anywhere close to being accurate. The Kurub was a Malak. The Malak are spiritual implements. Anyway, this particular Kurub went rogue, and he capitalized on his opportunity to engender Chawa's trust by misquoting God, making promises that he could not keep. Boy, if you want to read about that sort of thing, open the Quran. It is nothing from beginning to end in unfulfilled promises. He was not only wrong, his counsel was deceptive and deadly. Again, if you want to meet this same spirit, open the Quran. Chawa would in fact die, just not instantly, and she would become mortal, but her body would not fail concurrently. So, the venomous serpent, Nakash, this sorcerous snake, venomous viper, and spellbinding creature, replied to the woman, "You are absolutely not going to die. Lo, Muth, Muth, you will not actually come to embody death. You will not be assassinated or killed." That was partially true, but it has to be partially true for anyone to believe a lie. I mean, the Quran corrupts enormous amounts of the Talmud, which corrupts enormous amounts of the Torah and prophets. So there's always a shred of truth and the best lies. So Chawa would not die on this day. And that is what made Satan's deception appear credible. Outright lies seldom fool anyone. But when truth is twisted, when the counterfeit resembles the genuine article, that's when the bogus bill is beguiling. Now, if we want to be correct regarding the Word of God, we must be focused. We must be observant, thoughtful, respectful, and consistent. When we alter anything that Yahweh has said, or when we ignore the unique nature of the language, it is at our peril. What Yahweh actually stated was, "But from the tree of the awareness and knowledge of good, that which is beneficial and correct, and bad, that which is counterproductive and disadvantageous, do not make a habit of continuing to eat from it. As a consequence, in a day, you will absolutely die, defined by having eaten from it." Bereshit 2:17. Now, it is never wise to remove something Yahweh said from the context in which it was presented. It is also foolish to truncate his instructions, both of which Satan did in this instance. But the single worst thing anyone can do is to contradict God while encouraging others to believe them. Satan did this very thing with, "You absolutely will not die." Low makes the second statement the inverse of the first, an exacting replication of the wording inclusive of the most literal term, which is the call, the infinitive deception and depiction here, the imperfect conjugation and the verbal repetition, all strongly suggests that all of this was done knowingly and deliberately. In fact, the odds that it was done knowingly and deliberately are probably 99.99%. Now, no one wants to die, which is why Satan's deception is enticing. It's the appeal of every religion, and where an afterlife is promised to believers, but it's always a lie with a deadly consequence. Now, the realization that Muslims have been beguiled to believe that if they go off and rape, plunder, torture, and murder Jews, that they're entitled to multiple virgins in paradise, is so egregiously stupid that it's impossible to feel any pity for them. nor should one try to placate them or accept them or tolerate them. No one should be that easily fooled. No one should be that deadly. Now, false hope is tragic, particularly when the false hope requires somebody to do something heinous, as is the case of Islam. And it's sad when people succumb to it because it robs them of an opportunity to find and capitalize upon the truth. Worse, believers are manipulated and swindled in the exchange. Religion is not a victimless crime. With lies, the likes of this, which lie at the heart of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, it is both amazing and inexcusable that anyone should be beguiled into believing any of these, since no one has ever been a beneficiary. They only appear credible to the unsuspecting because they have placed their deceptions on top of Yahweh's testimony. They have intertwined them, concealing and corrupting the truth. This gives a veneer of believability that these deceptions would not otherwise engender. And at the same time, precludes many people, if not most, from posing what really should have been the most effective arguments against them. If a religion contradicts something which it derives its authority, it cannot be true. When a religion contradicts something from which it derives its authority, as is the case with Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, it cannot be true. It really is as simple as this. Since Yahweh's word is true, religions like Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, which contradict the Torah, cannot be true. And should you wrongly conclude that Yahweh's word is not true, religions which claim that they are divinely inspired, which garner their authority from it, as Judaism, Christianity, and Islam do, to lesser degrees of credibility as you go through time, they must therefore be false. Why? This simple logical exercise renders all three religions invalid, something any informed and rational person will immediately recognize. False dogmas prevail because very few people are informed and rational. And today, being informed and rational and trying to help people either be protected from the deadly assault of Islam, from the counterfeit of Christianity that is robbing them of their soul, is considered so unacceptable that you can't even share it. There are thought police throughout social media that do not allow you to criticize the source of most the death, thievery, corruption, deception on earth, religion. It's as if we're lost our ability to think, lost our ability to be rational, lost our ability to be compassionate or moral. Now, Satan took this particular agenda one step further, enticing Yahweh. Because instead, the Almighty knows that truthfully, in the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened. Then you will exist like God, knowing good and bad. Parashith in the beginning. 3:5. So this is Satan's appeal. All right. He's setting himself up as one who knows the mind of God, who there and not only knows the mind of God, is telling you that God is the conniving one. He's the one trying to hold you down. Satan is the liberator. He's the one trying to expand your horizons. He's trying to free you from the deceptions of God. In other words, Satan is presenting God as the opposite of who he is. He's presenting himself as the antithesis of the adversary. Keep that in mind, because when religions like Christianity, Judaism, and Islam speak of the adversary, that really is God. When they speak of Satan, or excuse me, they speak of God, that's really Satan. It's all role reversal. That's what's being presented here. And you should be able to detect it throughout religions. Because instead, the Almighty knows. He is Yada. He is aware. He recognizes that surely in the day that you eat, that you are nourished by consuming from it, your eyes will be opened. He's saying you're deliberately blinded by God. Your horizons are narrowed by God. Your opportunities have been constrained by God. He doesn't want you to know this stuff. But I do. Hey, you eat for it. You'll exist like God. Every religion in the world, same line. Oh, you follow this and you'll be in there with God. No sweat. Trust me on this. Truth. You will exist like God. You'll know good and evil. Well, he was right about that. You will know good and bad. Now, you may not be able to differentiate between them, which would be true today with almost everyone who is religious and almost everyone who is politically progressive, but you'd nonetheless have the capability. In psychology, this is called projecting, by the way. By using this tactic, the misleading cherub revealed that he was a psychopath and a narcissist. It was Satan who wanted to be like God, to be seen as above God. The adversary was revealing what he wanted. And he was doing so for all of us to behold. And as such, this is God's open invitation to read what he inspired Yeshaya Isaiah to write about Satan in the 14th chapter of his prophetic portrayal of Israel's past, present, and future. Satan wants to be like God. He wants to be God. He was projecting on Chawa what he himself craved. Egotistical and believing that he was superior to man, this snake did not think that we would ever see through his ploy or hold him accountable. Surprise, surprise. He was wrong. It's one of the reasons he despises my collaboration with Yahweh. As a psychopath and megalomaniac, Satan has no empathy. It goes with the territory and has an inherent disregard for humankind and for life. His failings define his character and his ambitions. With the adversary, it ends, the ends are Machiavellian. They always are justified, and they excuse any means to achieve them, no matter the extent of the carnage or of the suffering. In fact, the more carnage, the more suffering, the better, because he disregards humanity. He has no regrets. The sacrifice of 10 billion souls has been of no consequence. He'd prefer it to be 20 billion. He is fundamentally destructive. He has no remorse. Satan came right out of the closet and said that he is God in the Quran when he spends all of his time in hell torturing individuals were, he made the prime edict of the Quran to wage war on his behalf and fight to the death, killing all mankind. He wants to be worshipped. He wants prostration, prayers. He wants everyone enslaved to him. And anyone who does not capitulate, he wants his Muslim slaves to kill so that he has the opportunity to torture their physical bodies forever in hell. Why he rewards the killers and physical bodies as well with cravings that are really disgusting. This psychotic spirit is not only drawn to him the most esteemed among us. He will use such individuals and then toss them away. Or if he cannot persuade them to join him, he will seek to bring them down. The case of Shaul, Paul, he admits that he was demon-possessed and that Satan used him. And then you look at the end of Paul's life. He was alone and miserable. Not a single person believed him or was with him at the end of his life. Even Satan tossed him aside. Can't blame him, actually. He was a real jerk. The adversary is power hungry. He is manipulative. He is deceptive. He is delusional. He is exploitive and very, very Machiavellian. He sees himself as a victim and everyone else is simply a tool to be used to fulfill his ambition for restitution. Now, it's interesting. I use the term Machiavellian. Many of you know that there is a pejorative connotation of that term, but my guess is that less than 1% of you, maybe even a tiny fraction of 1%, have actually read The Prince or know what The Prince says about the ends justifying the means, or who the audience was in The Prince. Well, The Prince is a open letter to Italian royalty, and it tells them how to claim the throne of the papacy. And then it tells them how they should go about being popes. And it is written to the political elite in Italy, telling them that the most effective tactic for them to deploy is terror, to create a sense of fear and intimidation. So the prince, where the ends justify the means, and where the means is terror, was specifically written as a guidebook for popes in the Roman Catholic Church. In his case, the designated protector, the Korub who came off the wall, turned adversary, would deceive and denigrate the woman. To destroy the only loving relationship Yahweh had nurtured with the man, he would strike back at God by estranging them. Chawa would be collateral damage. Disparaging woman is a signature trait of narcissists. It is common to all of Satan's religion. Women are treated as property and as trash. Nothing's changed from the garden, has it? Satan approached the woman rather than the man directly. It's interesting, the ploys that he will use. It is also interesting, I must tell you, that Satan's ultimate game is to have either all men and women capitulate to him and worship him, Satan, as the Lord God, as is done throughout religions, but particularly in Islam. Or he wants everyone dead. And if he can't have everyone dead, then his prime objective is to exterminate Jews. And if you wonder why Islam is so anti-Semitic in this regard and why Jews are the primary target of the religion and the primary target of the egotistical mindset that is known as progressive politics, is because heretofore, Yahweh had conveyed his message through Jews, through Yehudim. And because he created the covenant with Yisrael and made a promise to Abraham in terms of reconciling his relationship with his offspring, Yisrael, that Yahweh's homecoming on Yom Kippurim has to be to Yisrael. The relationship that has to be restored and reconciled is with Yehudim and Yisrael. It's what is said in Yirmiyah 31. It is throughout the Torah and prophets. It's one of the most common themes throughout God's prophecies about this reconciliation that's going to occur between him and his people, Yisrael and Yehudah. So Satan's not stupid. He knows if all Jews are dead, that there can be no reconciliation. And if there's no reconciliation, there is no return. And if there is no return, he gets this wreck of a planet where almost all life is extinguished all to himself. No trip to Sheol. No return of Yahweh. No return of Dod. It's all for naught for Yahweh and for man. That's why he acts the way he does. It is why the book of Ezekiel goes on and on to depict 25 ways to ruthlessly kill Jews. And it has two chapters devoted to raping Jewish women. And then it has multiple chapters to the aggrandizement of the Lord as he reigns over Jerusalem. Well, not surprisingly, Paul, Akiba, and Muhammad were psychopaths also and narcissists, as is the Adonai Lord of the Talmud of the New Testament, the false portrayal of God, and the Quranic Allah. The picture is clear and available for all to read and see. With his words on this day, Satan revealed the means he would deploy through Judaism, Christianity, and Islam to dissolve and denigrate the covenant. And Yahweh would be frustrated, unable to enjoy a familiar relationship with Yisrael and Yehudah. And it has worked exceedingly well for a very long time. My mission is to bring an end to this estrangement at this time. Now, should you want to hone your perceptions of Satan, and it's helpful to know who the adversary is, Yahweh had me begin by excoriating Islam, Allah, Muhammad, the Quran, and Hadith for a reason. It is the place that is the easiest of all to understand the machinations of the adversary and to see what effect he is having on God's people, and through evidence and reason to thwart Satan's ability to kill Jews. That's why I went back and rewrote Prophet of Doom as goddamn religion. Part of this job is to protect God's people. Now, those who would advance Hasatan's agenda, I would encourage you to, if you want to know Satan, and as I say, those who advance his agenda, study psychopathy. A good book on the subject would be The Wisdom of Psychopaths. It was written by a British social psychologist. His name was Kevin Dutton. You will discover, as was the case here with Satan, projecting his desires to be like God onto Chawa, that psychopaths and narcissists, and their like psychopaths and borderlines, reveal their true nature and their purpose with their words. They always incriminate themselves. I know. I was born to one, and I was demeaned by another. Now, up to this point, all Adam and Chawa, Yada, knew, all they were aware of, all they recognized, experienced, acknowledged, and knew, was Yahweh and this beautiful sheltered enclosure of great joy that he had created for them. Everything was Tob. It was good, it was pleasing, beneficial, and beautiful. Until evil's advocates slithered down that wall. They had no knowledge of anything bad, sad, immoral, harmful, disadvantageous, or distressing, even deadly. Eden was paradise, a place of ultimate pleasure and total satisfaction. So it was true that by eating the fruit, Chawa would add an awareness of evil and of suffering to those pleasant things she already knew. But since she had already experienced everything good, the implied benefit was totally counterproductive. Satan was adding a negative and thereby diminishing the sum. It is ironic that by attempting to increase her knowledge, Chawa only succeeded in degrading her experience, as well as decreasing her life expectancy. She was not alone. The Torah is diminished by the Talmud. It's a net negative. The New Testament and the Quran also, when billions fail to appreciate the math. If not already enveloped in it, he will become aware of that which is bad, evil, distressing, and harmful. And our thoughts and our existence, when we know these things, cease to be perfectly good. We are constantly confronted with the choice between the two. Prior to such knowledge, neither Adam nor Chawa contemplated the concept of deception. They did not entertain the notion of harming anyway, of being harmed by another person. But now all of this was part of the mix. Few things are as destructive as an immature and irresponsible flirtation with deadly and destructive delusions. So while we must eventually choose to avoid such things to be moral, it isn't appropriate to discuss murder, rape, arson, armed robbery, terrorism, incest, or pedophilia, the things that made Muhammad famous, with a 2-year-old child, I guess, unless you're Muhammad and crawl in bed with a 6-year-old girl. Even if properly explained, this knowledge would put frightening thoughts into a child's head and torture their youth, perhaps foreclosing on the development of meaning relationships thereafter. Now, while an awareness of evil does preclude someone from living with the perfect God, engaging in it and spreading it will. So you can know lots of evil, and it's not going to keep you apart from God. And I had to learn it to write Goddamn Religion, Twistianity, as well as Babel. So you need to know it. And you actually become more like God when you know it and when you denounce it. But if you perpetrate it and encourage others to engage in it, it will preclude you from experiencing the, expending the end of your soul with its dissipation. If you lead people astray deliberately, if you're part of the problem, it's your soul is destined to go to Sheol, the place of separation. Fortunately for us, should we have been wrong in the past, The moment we disavow such things and avail ourselves of Dode's willingness to banish our guilt, we are perfected. You know, a great example would be Moshe. He grew up in Pharaoh's household, and so he would have been practicing pagan religions. He would have been fighting alongside the Pharaoh. He would have perpetrated that horrible and depressing caste system. He would have been part of the problem. But he grew a conscience, and he decided that he would oppose those things because they were wrong, and he saw the cruelty. He stood up against it, and then unfortunately was mocked by his own people for defending them. But these are the things that he had done, and yet from God's point of view, since he had disassociated himself from them, he was perfect in God's eyes and the perfect candidate to collaborate with to free his children, because he knew why God hated religion and politics and the caste system. He was already aware of these things, and he shared God's disdain for them. So knowledge can often be very, very good, even when it's knowledge of those things which are bad, counterproductive, and evil. Yahweh has knowledge of them and uses them to encourage us to avoid them. I do, and have written, 13 volumes of the books behind you devoted to sharing this very thing. Adam and Chawa were already like God. So this proposition from Satan was also a half-truth designed to deceive. At the conclusion of the sixth day, after having created animal life, God said, "Let us produce Adam in our image, after our likeness." Bereshith, Genesis 1:26. The word that was used is teslim, which is a two- or three-dimensional painted or sculptured representation of something larger, just as a shadow is a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional object between it and the source of light. Danuth, the other word used in this context, is a comparison or likeness in the form of an image. It is a builder's draft or sketch, a graphic representation of a future building or other construct. Just as a mirror reflects our image and a shadow represents our shape in one less dimension, we are fashioned to be fewer dimensions than God. And then, as a result of the covenant, elevated in dimensions to be more like him. He is eternal in time, the fourth dimension. We are not, at least apart from him. Now, completing the thought, in the next sentence, God revealed, "So God created Adam in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God knelt down to them, saying, 'Be fruitful, parah, and multiply, rabah.'" There is nothing better than being adopted into Yahweh's family and inheriting all he has to give by being part of the fruitful and productive harvest of Bukurim, Shabuah, and Teruah, so that you can be among the very fruit of God, growing with him and flourishing throughout Sukkah. By twisting Yah's words, Satan played to humanity's ego and to his, as well as fostering a sense of jealousy by projecting his most debilitating flaws. It's the same failing which caused a once useful spiritual messenger to be thrown out and cast down, excluded from Shamayim. Now he wanted man to endure the same fate that he had brought upon himself. Also worth noting, the corrupt Karub didn't just deceive Chawa. He actually did something far worse. He misconstrued God's nature and intent in the process. According to the adversary, God didn't want his creation enlightened. He didn't want humankind enriched and empowered, even though these happen to be the benefits of the Bereth covenant. He, according to Satan, had no desire for men and women to learn. The inference was that God was like the Wizard of Oz, you know, with the levers and the fire and the curtains and the projected booming voice. Should Chawa pull back the curtain, she would see an insecure little old man with his puny voice magnified, using those levers and making smoke and mirrors to maintain the illusion. One bite from the tree would be all it would take for Chawa to outwit God. Soon, she believed, there would be three, perhaps even four gods pulling the levers in Eden. Doesn't matter what you believe when what you believe doesn't matter. Perhaps this is why the gods of religion are so insecure. They need to be worshipped. Perhaps this is why the religious gods need man to build Oz-like cathedrals for them, grand edifices soaring to the sky, green with envy, with every element designed to impress, to keep ordinary men too intimidated to peer behind the curtain. The gods of religion would want men to bow down to them rather than to lift their creation up. They would be feared. It would all be like Oz, a show. Well, as a result of the misleading and insecure statements, all designed to miscast Yahweh's nature and to project his ambitions, Chawa began to see things from a different perspective. I'm going to share this with you, and then we will conclude this, the 10th episode of In the Garden, and pick up the story from where we leave it here, because there's so much more for us to learn. Then the woman looked, and she saw that indeed the tree was beautiful and pleasing, even as a source of food to consume, and that indeed it was visually appealing and desirable, even eliciting her cravings. So she coveted the tree to impart insights and to inspire success, even to convey understanding. Therefore, she grasped hold and seized from the fruit, and she ate. Then she also gave it to her man, who was in a relationship with her. So then he ate. Barishith, in the beginning, 3:6. We will have a field day with this statement in our next episode, because you can tell that this was all by perceptions. God had already given them instructions. They knew what this tree represented. And yet, they saw something way beyond anything God had conveyed to them. They, like Satan, began to project their own desires and cravings. And soon, the temptation for them was just too great. Soon, they would be like all other men. And rather than know and enjoy a relationship with the one true God, they would make gods in their image. We'll return to In the Garden, episode 11, tomorrow. I thank you for listening to the Yahweh blog. I am your host, Craig Wynn.